I'm Tom Kennedy. U.S. President Trump is suggesting the impeachment probe is why he did not tell lawmakers before Saturday on the raid on Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The president did give a heads up to Russia and other nations with forces in the region, but kept Congress's leaders in the dark.
I think Adam Schiff is the biggest leaker in Washington.
Schiff also chairs the House Intelligence Committee, which is playing a central role in the impeachment probe. Speaking to reporters, Schiff did not mention the operation, but did knock the White House for trying to keep another witness from testifying in the probe.
We go forward. Now armed with additional evidence of obstruction.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is planning a vote on Thursday to formalize the impeachment inquiry. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Speaker Pelosi, in a letter to House members, says the vote's being taken to eliminate any doubt about the process, since the Trump administration's trying to block witnesses and withhold documents. The Constitution doesn't require a vote to begin impeachment, but President Trump says that's why he's not cooperating. The White House also says the evidence gathered so far is irreversibly illegitimate. Meanwhile, the Justice Department is appealing a judge's order that it produce for Congress secret grand jury testimony from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Afghan officials say that Afghan and Pakistani forces engaged in cross-border clashes for a second day Monday. The latest violence came hours after Pakistani mortar and rocket fire killed three Afghan women in eastern Kunar province. That fighting first broke out on Sunday afternoon when Afghan forces and local militiamen tried to stop Pakistani forces from allegedly establishing a military installation along the disputed border. This is VOA News. Firefighters in the state of California battled a new blaze Monday that broke out near the Getty Museum in Los Angeles. It is the latest in a series of fires that is burning across the state. The Los Angeles mayor, Eric Garcetti, said that the fire on the west side of Los Angeles has grown to 200 hectares since it ignited before dawn Monday and has burned down at least five homes. The areas where some of the city's most expensive homes were located, and the fire forced thousands to evacuate. The European Union has agreed to a three-month extension to Brexit. Reuters' David Doyle.
With just 3 days until the United Kingdom is due to leave the European Union, and the EU has agreed to delay Brexit for another 3 months. President of the EU Council, Donald Tusk, announced a flextension, or flexible extension, on Monday, which means Britain could leave earlier than January the 31st, 2020, if its fractious parliament ratifies a divorce deal. This third Brexit postponement also comes with conditions, including a refusal to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement and a green light for the EU's members to meet without Britain to discuss the bloc's future.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Hundreds of thousands of Salvadoran nationals living in the United States for more than a decade will not have to return for at least another year as the Trump administration extends their temporary protected status. This according to the U.S. ambassador to San Salvador. El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele hailed the accord, saying that it will give his countrymen and the United States extra time to look for permanent solutions. Student protesters in Baghdad defied an overnight curfew Monday. Iraqi authorities had ordered people to stay off streets between midnight and 6 a.m. and another day of fierce anti-government demonstrations. At least three more people were killed and more than 100 hurt Monday in clashes between marchers and police. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda.
Iraq's military has reinstated a nightly curfew in that country until further notice in an effort to stave off anti-government protests that returned over the weekend with renewed ferocity. The death toll for the month of October stands at about 230 or more. One man said this isn't a protest, it's a revolution. The protests had calmed for about 2 weeks. It began as cries against high unemployment and lack of progress in the country, but as the anger grew, so did its focus. Particular anger is given to politicians seen as pawns in the power play between the United States and Iran.
I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Tuesday, October 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's government is accused of abusing the rights of journalists and opposition parties.
We had interviewed 68 people from different institutions, and all of them have one thing in common, that whenever they went out to speak against the government came after them.
Roland Ebole is an Amnesty International researcher on Tanzania. A religious leader calls on South Sudan parties to reach a consensus on forming a unity government. Kenya's economy is expected to grow at 5.6% this year. We'll examine the impact of ongoing flooding in Somalia. And a Ugandan opposition leader launches a new campaign to unseat President Museveni.
The main problem now that faces citizens is the state itself. And that is why the provisions of Article 3 of our Constitution are critical.
Dr. Chisa Besigye is a former president of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change. We look at sex for grace at the University of Ghana and mental health support for Ebola survivors. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say since the election of Tanzanian President John Magufuli, the government has enacted and enforced measures which they say have led to a sharp decline of freedom of expression and association. In a report released on Monday, Amnesty International detailed instances where it says senior government officials make antagonistic pronouncements regarding human rights abuses. It also expressed concern about what it says is going its ongoing restrictions of freedom of expression and association ahead of next year's Tanzania general election. Roland Ebole is an Amnesty International researcher on Tanzania.
We found that the state has repressed everyone who opposes it. And so we had interviewed 68 people from different institutions, from government to journalists to researchers, and all of them have one thing in common, that whenever they went out to speak against the government or to report anything that the government did not like, the government came after them. And so our report captures incidences and stories of these people who are repressed.
When you spoke to the government officials, what was their response to your research?
Their response was a bit mixed. When we talked to the Minister for Information, for instance, and presented a particular case where a researcher, Aidan Eyakuze, who works for Twaweza, actually heads Twaweza, after reporting a poll where Twaweza found that President John Magufuli's popularity was going down, and then the Commission of Science and Technology and government officials came after him with immigration officers taking his passport. When we presented that case to the Minister for Information, Dr. Harrison Makembe, what he did was saying that that was a case of a few rogue officers, or, you know, the typical a few bad apples in the group.
Supporters of the ruling party say that the government has a duty, a mandate perhaps, if you may, to protect the public from misinformation and fake news. How do you react to that?
I totally agree with regards to that, in terms of the government mandate to do that sort of protection, in terms of the regulatory mandate. The only point of departure from that is that now the government has instituted laws that prevent the researchers or the carriers of polls to freely impart information by coming up with stringent measures that would really make any person that presents their finding afraid of government action. Even though the law was amended to decriminalize the presentation of information that is unverified as official statistics, what it has done is that the government can force individuals to retract information that they presented as statistics or as, you know, findings to the public, or can force individuals to basically write an apology in the dailies while retracting that information. So it is a dangerous trend in that the government is not doing this in the regulatory sense, but is doing it in a way that is trying to compel anyone else to play to its music.
Roland Ebole is an Amnesty International researcher in Tanzania. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the capital, Nairobi. Uganda's top politician, Dr. Kizza Besigye, has launched a new campaign which he says will remove the government of President Yoweri Museveni. Besigye says he will work with other politicians to remove President Museveni from office before the 2021 general elections. But as Mugumi Davis Rakarich reports from Kampala, the ruling National Resistance Movement spokesman has dismissed Dr. Besigye's assertions.
The new campaign is named Turwaneko, translated as Let Us Defend Ourselves, and is aimed at ensuring that Uganda has a new constitution that respects the rights of every citizen. Colonel Besigye accuses the current ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, or NRM, to have run out of ideas on how to run the country. He says there has been unprecedented violence in the country. He also accuses the current government for not providing services like education and better health facilities to citizens.
For some years now, there has been rapid deterioration of security, people being killed all over the country without any explanation, without any check on the killings.
Basically, he also accuses the current regime for regional insecurity.
There is also the problem of the regional adventurism on the part of Uganda, taking our troops quite often illegally to the neighboring countries. Like our troops illegally entered Congo, plundered the Congo, and caused massive refugee situation out of Congo.
Rogers Muringwa, the ruling party spokesperson, says Besigye's claims are mere antics to make him relevant ahead of the 2021 general elections.
When you look at our health facilities, when you look at our education process, everything has gone up. We could be having some challenges too. Like any other government, there are issues where we need to do a little bit more. But we are not as bad off as we found this country. And that's the reason why. So every time we present ourselves as NRM, Ugandans have said, yes, we are the best choice for this country. And even 2021, we expect a slightly bigger margin than what we had in 2016.
Colonel Besigye has contested and lost 4 times against the incumbent president. But every time he has claimed elections were rigged in favor of his opponent. He says citizens will not wait for 2021 elections to demand for change.
The main problem now that faces citizens is the state itself. And that is why the provisions of Article 3 of our Constitution are instructive, are critical. They come into play when you have a rogue regime like we have now. Then citizens must take all necessary steps in spite of what the regime that violates the constitution is doing.
Colonel Besigye says he will organize a nationwide convention with other opposition politicians to kick off the campaign. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The Episcopal Church of South Sudan is urging signatories to the revitalized peace agreement to talk to one another and reach consensus on whether to delay or form a unity government next month. The Archbishop of South Sudan's Episcopal Church says the church is concerned about several uncoordinated position papers by various parties regarding what to do about the looming November 12 deadline. Winnie Shirino reports from Juba.
Justin Buddy Arama, Archbishop and Primate of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan, says as time winds down on the deadline to form a unity government, the country's leaders should bear in mind the continuous suffering of its citizens.
We do not want our leaders to take us back to war. If they think that it is fit to form the government on 12 November, let there be an inclusive government. And if they think that it is not possible because some of the metrics are not yet implemented, let them agree together and continue to dialogue until they see that all are in place.
Arama says security arrangements as well as the number of states and their boundaries should not be an obstacle to forming a unity government so long as political leaders agree on the way forward.
Everything is in their control. The trainings, the boundaries and everything, it is in their hands. That's why we are saying We need peace. So it is they, if they think the forces can be brought together, trained, it is in their hand. If they say they, we will continue to train them as we go on, it is in their hand. So our concern is we need peace and stability.
Arama, who was recently elected chairman of the Global South Churches, says he has spoken to other church leaders about the statement over whether to form a unity government in South Sudan next month.
I shared with them the current challenge we are in and the crossroad that we are now in, that they should pray for us, because we do not know on November 12th whether we shall have a new government in place or not. And if no new government, we need prayers that will enable us after November 12th to guide our leaders to do things which will bring a concrete and peaceful conclusion for the future of this nation.
Arama is urging the parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement in letter and spirit. He says the Episcopal Church will continue to pray for the leaders so that the Spirit of God guides them to do the right thing. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 29th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Kenya's economy is expected to grow at 5.6% this year, compared to the early estimate of 5.8%. As Kenyans struggle to make ends meet. Speaking in Nairobi during an economic summit, Kenya's central bank governor Patrick Njoroge said Kenya's cash flow is too low. Marie Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The International Monetary Fund, IMF, has revised downwards the projection of Kenya's economic growth this year to 5.6%, reflecting tough times for most sectors. Kenya's central bank governor, Patrick Njoroge, said that there is no enough cash flow in the country as Kenyans are struggling to earn a living.
Can't eat GDP. At the end of the day, what is needed is specific products, specific incomes. That is what your show and anybody else wants. At the end of the day, it is what really hits our pocketbook.
IMF has joined other institutions such as the World Bank and the Treasury, which have all lowered the country's economic outlook. However, the Washington-based institution expects that the economy will grow faster in 2020 by 6% as the country's stronghold agricultural sector recovers from effects of poor rains. IMF Director, African Department, Abebe Selassie, said that the change of tax terms is necessary for the government of Kenya, especially in funding its infrastructure projects.
Higher growth is generally the stronger it's associated with job creation, with more incomes in people's pockets. Again, as they both explained, it doesn't automatically follow that high growth reaches all parts of the economy. That's why it is incumbent on policymakers. Also, we try and do a lot of work to identify who's been left out and to put in place policies, measures to try and address that.
Retail, manufacturing, telecommunication, among other companies, are facing financial crisis, forcing the companies to lay off workers. As in the past 2 months, at least 9 companies have laid off 2,000 employees as more crisis looms. Former finance minister, who is also a Mani National Congress Party leader, Musalia Mudavadi, has blamed the government of too much commercial borrowing. Speaking to KTN News, Mudavadi said that many of the sector are suffering financially as there is no new creation of jobs in the country.
We are facing a high public debt. We cannot run away from that. In fact, even the IMF and World Bank have warned them about it, including the Central Bank of Kenya, that their appetite for borrowing is too high. So there's a crisis in the Kenyan economy. No new jobs are being created. The manufacturing is suffering. Agriculture is suffering. So when they say that everything is fine, I really wonder where they sit.
Last year, Kenya's economy grew by 6.3% as it was the highest in over 5 years as Kenya recovered from electioneering period and prolonged drought. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Nearly 182,000 people have been displaced due to ongoing flooding in Somalia, according to the United Nations. Kadir Mohammed is the director of disaster risk management at the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management in Somalia. He spoke to Ricky Stryak about the ongoing crisis and what measures, if any, are being taken to improve the situation.
People had been displacing for the last 2 or 3 weeks, mostly in Beledweyne and district. In Beledweyne town, it has been inundated by water all over the city, and people were on the move since then. People were evacuated because they were used to be flooding from time to time, but this time of year, it is a bit unusual because in their season, and the flooding has not been usual since 1997 and 98.
Are these communities already vulnerable in certain ways?
Of course, these communities were vulnerable because for the last 2 seasons, they experienced a prolonged drought, and which has affected them in terms of their capacity. Then all of a sudden, this flooding came out of nowhere. And of course, yes, both hazards are very usual in Somalia. We either have flood or we do have drought. But people's capacity is diminishing this time because...
What kind of man-made factors are at play with this? Are these communities sometimes built on flood-prone areas? How is the government trying to make sure that what people can control is actually taken into consideration so that this won't happen again?
This is very difficult to respond to because... talking about man-made, yes, they are security-wise, we're not doing okay, but that does not mean it affects people 100%. It's the combination of the other hazards, like the drought of flood, which are combined with insecurity and accessibility issues. So people fall into vulnerability all of a sudden.
Kadir Mohammed is the Director of Disaster Risk Management at Somalia's Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management. You're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Mogadishu. The University of Ghana has been in the spotlight this month after an investigation by the BBC alleged that teachers sexually harass students and in some cases demand sex for good grades. Activists say sexual exploitation at the university is not new, but hope attention to the scandal will inspire more victims to speak out. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
The University of Ghana is looking into the allegations against staff in the BBC investigation, which found teachers harassing would-be students. The Sex for Grades documentary showed university lecturers at both the University of Ghana and the University of Lagos propositioning female reporters who were posing as students. Ghanaian activist Eugenia Barfour contributed research to the investigation. She says abusers often operate with a sense of impunity. However, she says the fallout is causing more victims to speak out.
Something good has already come out, even for the number of stories that came out, the kind of courage and strength they gave a lot of victims and survivors to speak out about their abusers was a huge step for us in the right direction when it comes to not being silenced anymore as a victim.
As first reported by the BBC, there are increasing allegations of sexual harassment by teachers at West African universities. The University of Ghana's Anti-Sexual Harassment Committee is investigating two of the accused, who have both denied the allegations. The committee head, Margaret Amakwaheni, says they are intensifying the outreach but need student victims to come forward.
All we ask of them is that don't endure any humiliation, don't endure any harassment. Let us take that responsibility. And once you inform us, you are virtually saying, I'm offloading this burden on you, take it up. And we shall do that. But if you don't tell us and you keep it to yourself, you are emboldening the perpetrator.
The University Student Representative Council Women's Commissioner says that while the allegations of sex for grades are disturbing, they are not new. She hopes the scandal will bring awareness to students who were not familiar with the university's policy that they can and should report harassment.
We feel over the year there hasn't been the enabling environment for victims to approach the SRC and address or inform them about these malpractices or these mishappenings that are going on. So we are creating the enabling environment. So it's like a peer-to-peer group.
Meanwhile, the Student Council is launching a campaign to support victims of sexual harassment and also want to educate teachers about inappropriate behaviour with students. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
The head of a project that provides mental health support to Ebola survivors in Liberia during that country's Ebola epidemic says such care should be extended to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mavis Autry has more.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is grappling with the second largest Ebola outbreak on record, with more than 2,000 lives lost and 3,000 confirmed infections in 15 months. And neighboring countries are taking steps to reduce the risk of spread. In 2015, the Carter Center started a three-year initiative to address psychological effects of Liberia's Ebola crisis and to promote psychosocial health in the country. Janice Culper, a senior project advisor for the Carter Center's Liberia work, she says mental health workers found that just the fear of contracting the disease caused extreme stress.
What I would say is that what helped us a lot was to really spread psychosocial, even in communities that were not impacted, because the fear alone is something that would get people to have aberrant behaviors. They may run away, they may hide themselves, they may hide others. And so if you start with psychosocial, recognizing that it's not only the communities that immediately have Ebola cases, but also other communities, it really helped.
Corpa says the community healing dialogue in Liberia during Ebola outbreak helped to provide support for survivors. She hopes that the World Health Organization and other aid groups can begin to provide such help in the DRC.
Ebola really touched on a lot of mistrust, lack of what we call social cohesion within communities. And so you needed to work on and what we call collective efficacy, the idea that we're all in this together.
COPPA is concerned that funding for mental health and psychosocial support gets ignored around the world. She calls for increased funding for mental health issues, noting that depression and anxiety rates rise sharply in countries hit by trauma such as disease outbreaks, poverty, war, and famine. The Carter Center in Liberia has trained more than 300 teachers in identifying needs, referring patients for help, and working with children in social, emotional, or behavioral disorders. Reporting for the VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch say since the election of Tanzanian President John Magufuli, the government has enacted and enforced measures which they say have led to a sharp decline of freedom of expression and association. In a report released Monday, Amnesty International detailed instances where it says senior government officials make antagonistic pronouncements regarding human rights abuses. It also expressed concern about what it says is ongoing restrictions of freedom of expression. And that is it for this Tuesday, October 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the first ever Russia-Africa summit in Sochi marks a new era of economic, military, and political engagement between Russia and the continent. We'll take a closer look on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news At the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.